Accession number 17476, Reel 2.
This is Burn Reel 2. Was the site work any different in Cairo from what you'd already done in Greece?
No.
What happened to you next?
Well, I worked in the GHQ, the Army Cipher Office, for a year. And then somebody, I didn't pull any strings or know anybody, but somebody decided that I should deal with a great heap of captured books that had come in from the desert and try to make them into a little intelligence library. They were practically all in German. They were army manuals, illustrated on the whole, guns of various kinds, tanks and lorries for lorried infantry. So I arranged those on shelves and made a catalogue which I used to have sent round the intelligence offices, and then people would come in from time to time and look things up. Particularly the long-range desert group, because they wanted to drop behind the German lines and they could do with all the information possible. And one day, a young captain came in wearing a little purple medal ribbon, and after he'd gone, I had a sergeant then, and I asked him whatever the medal ribbon was, because we had no ribbons during our war until it was over. People were only wearing some Palestinian campaign medal ribbons. And the sergeant said, "Don't you know, miss, that's the VC." And also, he was posthumous. So I felt we'd both seen him. It wasn't a ghost. And so I asked him about this. He said it was awarded in Eritrea. The officer was seen to fall, bleeding profusely from the head, and presumed dead. So it was gazetted as a posthumous VC. And the Italians picked him up and looked after him in a hospital. He recovered, and when we went back to Eritrea, he was just freed from the Italians and joined the Long Range Desert Group.
Do you remember his name?
I think it was Wilson. I could verify it in our library from the army list. He survived the war, and I looked him up in the army list about 7 or 8 years ago.
I think you're right, because I think I've interviewed him.
Have you? Have you really?
So this is in Cairo in 41-42?
Yes.
Were there any war scares there whilst you were working there?
Yes, there was one when all the Egyptians started rushing to get money out of the bank and to go south. This was the time of Alamein, of course. Whole brigadiers could be seen with waste paper baskets on the roof of GHQ, I'm told, but by that time I was working for Bletchley out at Heliopolis, so I never saw them. And bits of half-burnt paper floated down from the roof of GHQ. So it was called Ash Wednesday. It was sometime in the summer.
I think it might have been in June 1942.
I think it was. I was just going to say, I think June.
Did you feel that the Germans were going to get through to the canal?
I'm sorry, it's difficult to get back to what I felt. I don't remember being very frightened. Oh, I was not frightened, because working then for Bletchley, I knew one couldn't be captured. I mean, a personal fright. One would have been deeply distressed that one's country was doing so badly, but not personally worried.
How did you get the job working for Bletchley Park?
I don't really remember. I'm sorry about this, but I don't. I think it was just having done so much work with ciphers.
What exactly was the job?
It wasn't anything to do with ciphers. It was translating. Translating from German, first of all, the German pilots' conversations, and keeping a list of the Luftwaffe officers and men, I suppose, whom we knew anything about. I mean, enough to put in a card index.
How good was your German?
Not very, but I had, fortunately, the vocabulary was limited. I'd done a bit of archaeological German, because, of course, almost any study one goes into at all deeply, you've got to know German.
Do you remember the type of things that you had to translate? Any details about them?
No. All I remember is when these German pilots were talking together, one was delighted when there was Achtung, Spitfire, and the conversation stopped.
So your work had nothing to do with the ultra information?
No. I didn't see any of that at all. There was a large... I just had a little cubbyhole room, and there was a large office nearby that full of Foreign Office people, because the Heliopolis set up, which was in an Egyptian museum, that had never had anything in it. The Egyptians had only just finished doing the outside, and the army came in with a lot of plywood and partitioned off various little rooms as offices. Well, rooms with any size. And one just didn't know what was happening in the adjacent rooms. Bletchley was very, very secret.
Do you remember any of the personnel with whom you were working, or under whom you were working?
I remember the arrival of... I wasn't working under anybody special, anybody who told me that. But the arrival of Miss Anderson from the Foreign Office, who was a professional. I never realized that code breaking went on in peacetime before. And she came, and everybody was most respectful of Miss Anderson. She was the sort of great queen bee, one might almost say. She had a very discreet obituary in the Times sometime in about the 60s, 70s.
Any incidents that happened to you whilst you were there?
Well, if you call landmine, if you call the dropping of two landmines quite close to the office was just beside the aerodrome, which the Air Force must have taken over. It was 276 Wing, was the name of the station there. And these two landmines were dropped, and all the military transport, which went very close by, just off the Suez Road, all the military transport and everything was stopped. But as we had special Bletchley passes, we were allowed in. It was our office, had to go on for 24 hours, so we were allowed in. When we got in, we were told to pull our tables and chairs into the middle of this place and then just go on. And it so happened that neither of those landmines exploded, so we simply said "Made in Czechoslovakia" and went back to our rooms.
Made in Czechoslovakia?
Yes. A resistance, no doubt. I mean, we don't know where they were made, but that was our guess. Oh, we had a nice little effort on the part of two or three Italian prisoners of war who came and endeavoured to make a garden outside the officers' mess, just on the edge of the desert. They planted a few zinnias, and when they started planting palm trees, we felt this was rather too bad, putting the war on a very permanent footing. They were perfectly happy, the Italians.
How did your job at Heliopolis come to an end?
I had been unwell for much of the time in Egypt. I suffered from ENT trouble. And I suddenly got an acute mastoid and was rushed into the 9th General Hospital and operated on just as soon as they managed to shave half my head. And I was told by the anaesthetist, whom we happened to have met in the same pension, that I wouldn't have survived the night. He said, "You had about 4 hours to live," and they took 4 hours operating on you. But it was quite an experience. It's really rather comforting to have had a dress rehearsal for the inevitable. All one's anxieties just go if you're being taken to an operating theatre and you may come out dead. It really is quite interesting.
Was it because your living conditions were unhealthy?
Is there filthy dust in Cairo? Absolutely filthy. The major who operated on me said, "Now I know this operation very well. I have at least seven, men, army personnel, in every week with mastoids."
Did you make a complete recovery?
I did. And I went up to Port Said and convalesced with a college friend of mine who happened to have married the chaplain.
So there's no question of you going back to work in Heliopolis again?
Either I asked for, or else it was seen that the climate was not good for me at all, I think I must have asked if it's possible to go to Jerusalem, and that so I was sent to Jerusalem to Air Headquarters Levant, as I'd been working for the RAF side of Bletchley. Well, I mean the Heliopolis outstation.
What was the atmosphere in Palestine at that time?
Oh, bliss after Egypt. I mean, I don't mean as regards the war, but I mean as regards one's living. It was just so healthy and bracing. I had a very uninteresting little secretarial job there, which I did pretty badly, as I've never never trained as a typist. But it got me into a good place. And I walked across the old city of Jerusalem. I lived just inside the Jaffa Gate, and the Air Force office was just outside the Damascus Gate. Four times a day I walked through the old city, which is really quite an experience.
Then I think you returned to Cairo?
Yes, well, I absolutely out of the blue, I got a letter from the embassy to the Greek government in exile. We'd become an embassy by then, and of course the Germans were still in Greece. So they set up this embassy in Cairo. They asked me if I would like to come and work there. And I accepted with tremendous joy to be into something Greek, because of course it absolutely assured one's return as soon as possible.
And the nature of the work that you did?
Oh, translating from Greek. Greek reports sent out by Greeks of the situation there, which of course was dreadful, lack of everything.
Anything about the political situation there?
Well, there were various things going on. I haven't verified when the mutiny in the Greek Navy took place. It might have taken place before I got there. But the embassy trying like anything to get some ministers out of Greece so there would be some sort of Greek government when we got back. And by that time my husband was up in Aleppo writing reports of that people came through Turkey and got out at Aleppo, where the army of course took hold of them. And he wrote reports of the situation in Greece and of the coastal defence and all the different military and naval positions that were taken by the Germans, so we should know what was happening there in the way of defence.
Had it surprised you that the Greek Navy should have mutinied?
I don't remember what I thought at the time. I can't remember what the mutiny is about, actually. They'd hardly have bothered about pay and hours in a war. One didn't. The TUC must have been in abeyance.
Anything else that happened to you in Cairo before you left again for Greece?
Well, I was twice in contact with smallpox. I don't know if that's worth mentioning.
You mean you contracted it?
No, I didn't, because I was vaccinated. I was vaccinated and had the opportunity to be vaccinated at any time, just to go to an army surgery. And I asked a doctor, I said, if you've been in contact with smallpox, what has developed as smallpox, what would you do? He said, I'd just have another vaccination. So I did that. One of the girls at the embassy, a secretary, I think, a typist, not a diplomatic one, come out from England, and because it wasn't one of the services, it was not noticed that she had never been vaccinated at all. Her mother had had a son who'd had very bad go of vaccine fever. And so she said, well, I'm not going to go through all that again with my daughter. And then she was sent out to Egypt, of all places, where there's always smallpox about, and typhus.
How did you come to go to Athens again?
Ah, well, by the summer of 1944, I was again rather run down with the Egyptian climate and asked for some compassionate, health leave, went to Cyprus for 2 or 3 weeks and to a camp on Troodos. And while I was away, the embassy suddenly went to Italy on the way to Greece. As soon as I heard that, of course, I dashed down and got into an RAF plane, a little RAF plane, to Alexandria. It was one of those planes that has no seats at all. You sit on the floor, and one's back has to be curved because there's no proper back either. However, I got down there and then got into a troop ship at Alexandria. There were five other women, otherwise it was absolutely packed with troops. And when we emerged from our stuffy little cabin next to some warm part of the ship, could have been the engine room, somewhere near the engine room. We were assailed with catcalls and wolf whistles unendingly from all these chaps, these troops on the deck below. So, of course, we had to retreat back into our horrid little cabin. It was not a pleasant journey back, but I thought, after all, the end is Greece. One must put up with this.
What situation did you find once you got to Athens?
Well, when we got to Athens at dusk, actually, and the captain refused to bring the ship alongside, or as near alongside as he could, because there was only a very narrow passage swept of mines and cleared of innumerable wrecks. And so he just wasn't doing it. Of course, one panted with impatience to get ashore. But we were rewarded. Total blackout of the city and of the ships. And then suddenly, a bright, small light shone in Athens. And looking through the field glasses, one could see the Greeks had floodlit the Parthenon. So the light went on again in Europe. They'd saved the floodlighting from the Germans, who would have smashed up everything as they retired.
What condition were they in, the civilians?
The civilians, very, very short of food. Terribly short. They were making bread out of things like squashed lentils. We, at the embassy, we were told we must have a self-denying ordinance and not buy anything from the Greek markets, anything at all, for 3 months. So we lived on tinned army rations, reduced army rations, and had vegetable pills on the table, which did keep us all right.
What are vegetable pills?
Well, they're pills which supply the vitamins you get in vegetables. And if we found some dandelion leaves in the garden, that was a treat. And once a Greek guest of ours presented us, this was the time when we'd started giving little parties to Greeks, she presented us with an enormous Eleusinian cabbage, which did our little mess of about 10 or 12 people for 2 or 3 days. It was wonderful to have some vegetables.
What was the law and order situation like in Athens?
It was all right then. There was no noticeable trouble, and we had a honeymoon period in... Did I tell you that this was October 44? I think round about the 20th. The Germans started pulling out on about the 14th. And I've just lost... what I was talking about.
You were just going to tell me about the law and order.
Oh, law and order. Yes, well, it seemed perfectly all right then. And we were able to take, in turn, there were only 2 jeeps at the embassy, little runs out into the country. We went out about twice. Once to Eleusis, and the site was being guarded by a guerrilla, armed to the teeth with great bandoliers across his shoulders. But we spoke to him in Greek and he answered quite politely and let us go round the site without paying. And then our second one was up Parnes, Mount Parnes. And there were several guerrillas, all armed to the teeth. But we had a little chat with them and came back. With hindsight, of course, one sees them drawing in round Athens. Then on the 3rd of December, what the Greeks sometimes call the movement, the kinema, broke out. There was a huge demonstration in Constitution Square, you know, the main square. And nobody seems able to tell, even quite impartial witnesses, who fired first, whether it was the police or the communists. But anyway, 9 people were killed, and that was the beginning, and we were besieged. The beginning of the communist attempt to liquidate us and gain power in Athens.
Did you see anything of that demonstration in Constitution Square?
No, I didn't. No. But near that time, we went for a walk to the Acropolis, and we walked, my husband and I, and we went up the north side, which looks out on the ancient marketplace, and the temple, the Hephaestion, as it's now called. And